Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 242, and we're going to talk about, the best. That is, what is the best? Do you want the best? And you know, maybe you really don't want the best. We're also going to talk about belt dressings, which is much less prurient than it sounds, a tale from the robe from a guest, Big Rob, and a place to visit that's kind of sad and yet kind of important. Hello, everyone. Welcome back once again. And I have some news. I have some news. It sounds like an important thing, right? It's news. It's not that important, but it's very important to me, and it does sort of impact the podcast, kind of. And basically, I'm leaving Facebook. I know. You're like, oh, it's not an airport. You don't have to announce your departure. Yeah, I get it. It's just social media. It's not that important. But it is. And this decision I'm making about leaving Facebook has come after a lot of thought. It's not something I'm not rage quitting. It's something I've done. It's something I've decided to do after thinking about it for a very long time, and I'm going to do it in as thoughtful a way as I can. But it's important. This is my basic conduit to social life. You know, I spend most of my time alone, which is fine. And I have all these friends from all over the world, from all different parts of my life, who are all on Facebook. This is where we gather. And I'm leaving that. And the reason I'm leaving it isn't because I don't want to stay in touch with those people. That's absolutely not true. And it's not because the personal experience I have of using Facebook is that bad that I have to leave. It's because they've broken my policies. you ever go to a business and you want something? Let's say you go to a restaurant and you're like, can I get extra tomato with that? And they say, well, I'm sorry, that's against our policies. Well, this is the reverse of that. I have certain policies in my life, and if organizations or people violate those policies, I have to terminate the relationship. And for me, for my personal policies, Facebook has violated those policies. In fact, they've done it many, many times, but now they've done it so much that there's no coming back. So I could probably spend a few hours about my decision-making process here and whatever, but the important part is that leaving Facebook, I have a Built2Go Facebook group. I know some of you on Facebook. This does create some issues that need to be resolved. And my trips that I take, I organize them mostly through Facebook. Leaving Facebook is, as they would say, a bad business decision. But I'm not a business person. This may cost me dearly, but I think violating my policies, in a way, costs me everything. I don't know what's going to happen, but that's in the future. I don't know what's going to happen with the Facebook group. I have to figure that out, but I am leaving Facebook. In the meantime, I will be on Blue Sky. I may create a Built2Go presence for Blue Sky, although, you know, it's such a small audience, I don't know that that matters, but I will probably do that. And, well, I'll save the news for the resource recommendation for something very personal and possibly too ego-driven. Okay, that aside, let's talk about the best. The best! Don't you want the best? Everybody wants the best. There is the best, you know? Like, if you're going to build out an electrical system in your van, you want the best electrical system, right? So let's go into Google and type in best electrical system for a van. Actually, I'll change it to van life. How's that? There you go. And of course, we get a bunch of ads, something from Craft Autoworks, something from Renogy, something from EcoFlow, and then we get Reddit. And then, if you've been paying attention to what goes on in van life right away, the first actual thing that comes up that isn't something that somebody's trying to bump up that I know of is Far Out Ride. Now, Far Out Ride is an excellent resource. I've talked about it before, and they will talk you through all the various ways to build your van. And it's incredibly detailed, and it's like a recipe. If you're looking for a recipe on how to build out an electrical system for your van, faroutride.com has that. It's amazingly detailed. I mean, they list which brand and type of everything you need. For example, let's see, and this is a guide you can download. This is for a standard optimized off-the-grid for energy efficiency. They recommend a Blue C terminal box, a Blue C system switch, a Blue C bus bar, a cover for the bus bar. Okay, well, that's not a big deal. another Blue Sea fuse block, and oh, there, Victron battery monitor, and new POWA mono panels. I have some new POWA stuff. That's good. Battleborn batteries, and so on and so forth. These are names you've probably heard, because often when people say, what is the best in regards to electrical power, Victron and Blue Sea come up to the top. They also have one if you want a really high power system, and if you look at that, it's the same brands, they've just changed some things a little bit. Why am I talking about this? I mean, this is great, right? Everybody has the best. We know where to go. We know where to find it. We have an absolute blueprint for how to have the best electrical system in your van. Well, my issue, as it is with many things in life, is what is the definition of best? Caveat, I have nothing against faroutride.com. If you follow what they're doing, you're going to end up with an excellent build. Go ahead and take a look at them. What I'm about to say is not a slight against Far Out Ride. It's a different perspective. And that perspective is this. Best has context, and the context is somewhat lacking in all of these things we call the best. For example, I remember when I worked at America Online, and, you know, in the early days, we were pretty hands-on. So even though my job was basically to answer phones when I first started there, I was also elbow deep in computer guts from time to time, replacing hard drives and RAM chips and setting IRQ jumpers. Yes, I'm old. That kind of thing. And one day somebody said, shouldn't you be wearing a ground strap? So a ground strap, if you're not familiar, is this, it's this strap you wear on your wrist and you connect it to the chassis of the computer, and it makes it so that, hopefully, you don't have a big spark when you move something. Like, you don't have a static shock and blow up a chip, which is something I have done. That's a real phenomenon. And I was like, yeah, I probably should, but et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I had all these things. Like, first off, I knew how to ground myself before I touched this stuff. And I didn't have a ground strap, and this needed to be done right away, and if I had taken the time to get a ground strap, that would have taken a whole day, probably, and I would have had to go through the bureaucracy of how to actually get one. There were lots of caveats. And then he said, well, just so you know, that's best practices. And I thought about that, like, best practices. We should follow best practices. But my real issue with this is that it's immutable. There is this best thing that's best in all circumstances. It ignores context and it never can change. It is always best practice to use a strap when you're working on your computer. Okay, maybe that point's arguable. What then about hooking up the power cord to the computer while you're working on it? And you might think, well, no, that's ridiculous. You obviously want to have the power disconnected. Except that that power cord provides a ground. It provides a ground to a massive grounding system that could help prevent problems if something goes wrong. So what's the best then? Well, you know, things get a little gray, and then maybe you call in experts and they decide what the best practice is. In short, what best practices end up being is a guideline for new people who haven't thought this all out, and that you need that. You need, if you're a new person and you don't understand a system, you need that guideline, that recipe for figuring out what to do. I think calling it best practice isn't right, though, because there are times when there are better practices. That may not have been a great example, but that's where I came to this thought. So, you've got the Far Out Ride best practices, and you look at that, and you go down the list, and of course they have Amazon links for everything, which is absolutely fine. I have no issues with that at all, because I do the same thing. There are, for each of these different systems I described, over, it looks like, what do we got here? Almost 100 different items to get, and you're easily talking many, many thousands of dollars to get all this equipment, and then you have to build it out to really exacting specifications. This, though it is a detailed recipe, it is excellent for a technician. If you're somebody who has no idea how to do this stuff and you're just winging it, this ends up not being helpful. It might be best, but it doesn't help you solve your problem. So how can that be the best? So my approach to things is much more about optimal. Consider all the variables, consider who you are, where you are, what you are, how much money you have, how much time you have, how much tolerance for frustration you have. All these things, it's an incredibly huge algorithm. And then make a decision. That's how I built my vans. My Vans are not the best. Neither of them is the best. Nothing in there is the best. I mean, anything that is in any of my vehicles could be looked at and you could say, well, there's a better way to do that. Yeah, there is. I could have spent $1,000 more and had more power. That would have been better. Except that I like that $1,000. I was able to take that $1,000 and go on a trip somewhere or buy another computer or whatever. I think you get my point. So ultimately, all I'm trying to say is try to avoid the cult of the best. And when I say cult, I mean that in a way because I have seen people that are so obsessed with getting the best that they kind of lose the big picture of what problem they're trying to solve. For example, let's say you build out this far-out ride system and it's perfect, everything's working great, and then a year later, a component comes out to replace one of the ones you already have, and it's a little bit more efficient. Or it has a feature like maybe this one has a configurable panel, and you can change the colors of the display so that they match all the other displays, whatever it might be. That new one is now the best. And people in the cult of the best will agonize over that because they have to have the best, and they have to get that new item and put it in, even though the old one, which used to be the best, worked completely fine and solved the problem. In a way, they're replacing the problem they actually have with this new problem of, I must have the best. And I was like that to some extent. Back in 2000-ish, when I had a lot of money and I was refitting a house, there was this big empty room in the house we didn't know what to do with. So I said, what if we had our own movie theater? And so this is a lot more common now, but back then that was pretty radical. So we had a movie theater built in and put in this really fancy projector and screen and all kinds of crazy equipment. And it was great. I liked it. I loved it. I would never do it again. For two reasons. One is the world has changed and I've changed and I'm just as happy watching a movie on my phone as I am in a theater these days, which is kind of a sad statement, but true. The other thing is that the entire time I was in that theater watching movies, I was distracted from the movie by the stuff. I was like, is that thing performing right? Do I need to tweak the amplifier more to get the sound right? You know, I think that front left speaker isn't really doing the surround sound the way it should. That's all I could think about. I was sitting there literally just trying to tweak everything. And then whenever I went to somebody else's theater, like an actual movie theater, I'd find all these deficiencies and like, oh, that's not the best there. I mean, the sound in my theater is better. And if they put transducers on, blah, 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 blah. I have really come to embrace optimal and good enough. I think those are better principles. And I think if you're listening to this podcast and you have $200,000 to spend on your van, this message may not be for you. But if you're somebody with $10,000 or $100, I think this is a really important message. You don't need to have the best. You also don't need to have this trash truck backing up beeping here, but that's what I've got. You don't need it. It's nice. It's a good goal. It can teach you things. This list from Far Out Ride will absolutely teach you a ton about electrical stuff. But it isn't essential. You can do van life without having the best. And chasing the best can get in the way of you doing van life.
Thus concludes today's sermon on Built to Go.
Hey, really big thank you to Craig and John who've become members of buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. I really appreciate you listening and your support. Because of you that we don't have ads. I hate ads. You hate ads. No more ads. Folks can just support me like this once in a while. We won't have any ads. If you would like to support the show, you can buy me some diesel at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. One-time payment, become a member, whatever you'd like. There really aren't any benefits to doing this other than knowing that you're helping to keep ads off of this podcast. And I will end this ad right now. Van life news. Well, big news this week, obviously, wildfires in California. If any of you in California, I hope you are safe and have a plan because, as they've been saying on the news, I mean, this just happened in an hour. There was like, oh, look, a little smoke, and then, in just an hour. So, folks, if you're doing any kind of camping or van life or traveling in wildfire areas, you have to stay connected to some news source. Now, I know a lot of us like to head out there and be disconnected, turn off the Wi-Fi, turn off the phone, just chill. But there are times when you need to actually be connected, and wildfires is one of the biggest of those. Because even just checking in once a day may not be enough. you do need some situational awareness. And especially if you're in, you know, California or the Pacific Northwest or Montana or Canada or any of these places that have frequent wildfires. So I hope everybody is safe. The pictures are devastating as they always are. But consider that if you're looking to escape from the world, it's not really safe to do that in wildfire zones. And, you know, I'll have a link in the show notes if you don't have any idea what I'm talking about, but I think you probably do. Next, this has made the rounds, and I actually posted this on Facebook. Mercedes now have cars that they're selling that you're not allowed to open the hood. No, really. If you look in the owner's manual, it says, no user serviceable parts. You should always go to a certified Mercedes technician if you wish to open the hood. And there's not even a way to open the hood for somebody. I mean, there is a way, of course. There's a hood, and there's stuff under there. You have to get to it. Well, but you don't have to get to it. The Mercedes dealer does. And what they've done is they've taken a hood latch and stuck it under a bolted-on plate. So in order to get to the hood latch, you have to undo this plate. And then you pull on the hood latch, but that doesn't really pop the hood up. Someone else has to lift the hood, and then when they lift the hood, there's no prop. There's nothing to hold the hood up. And I saw some clips from a Mercedes dealer on how they deal with this, and they just, like, stick a broomstick in there. That's how they hold the hood up on these vehicles that cost over $105,000. I'm actually talking about an electric vehicle, so you might think, well, there's nothing under there, right? There's nothing. But there is. There is stuff under there. The jump ports, if you need to recharge the 12-volt battery, which actually is how electric vehicles work, there's still a 12-volt battery in there that powers the electronics that enable the car to control the massive battery in the back. That can die, and then you still need to jumpstart the vehicle, even though there's no engine. That stuff's under there. Also, the coolant fill and check reservoirs are under there. That seems like something you should look at. The air filter is under there, which is not an engine air filter. It's a massive cabin air filter, but it's still a filter. And one of the videos, I'll link it in the show notes. In the video, the area in front of the filter was filled up with leaves, so you'd have to get under there to clean the leaves. Also under there is the washer fluid. But, oh no, don't worry. Mercedes is smart. This is a high-tech vehicle. You can fill the washer fluid without having to open the hood because they built an entirely separate little door on the side of the vehicle that you can open and then fill with washer fluid, which I can't tell if it locks or not, but that also means that anybody can fill it with washer fluid or anything else they'd like to because it's just this, like, you know, cheesy looking door on the side. Anyway, how does this affect van life? Well, unless you're in a Mercedes EQS, it probably doesn't directly, but I think this is a sign of things to come, is that you are going to be expected to have the dealer do all the work on your vehicle going forward as a way simply to maximize revenue. As it happens, my wife's 2012 Scion IQ is in the shop right now, which is the first time ever since we've owned this thing for how long? 13 years we've ever had to take it to the dealer. And they quoted me all this stuff. I mean, they're fixing some stuff that I want them to fix. Long story, doesn't matter. But they quoted me other stuff. Like, for example, there's a brake light out, which I didn't realize. I'm glad they told me. They want $72 to replace the brake light. Oh, but one of the license plate lights is out too. $69 to replace that. And the interior cabin air filter, which I don't think I even have, $102 to replace that. And it's not the parts. Those parts do not cost that much. Anyway, yikes. Count me firmly in the camp of used vehicles are better, and I'm really starting to get to be a Luddite because I'd like to be able to fix stuff myself. And I know a lot of you are in that situation too. So be sure you know what you're getting into when you buy a vehicle. And finally, the other big news, which this does impact van life, it impacts life, is the New York City's congestion pricing. So you're familiar with tolls, you got to pay a toll to drive on certain roads, to go across bridges, etc. Now you need to pay a toll to go to Manhattan at all. A big, huge section of Manhattan now has tolls just for you to drive in the city. And it's $9. Every time you drive in the city, it costs $9. Forget the bridges. We're not talking about the George Washington Bridge or the interstate. No, it's just to go into the city. And the idea is that if we make this more expensive, fewer people will drive there, which will probably work. I know all the cyclers are excited about this, and some of the pedestrians and some of the eco-friendly folks are really think this is a great thing. But another way to look at this is, That means this is only a place for rich people. I mean, let's say that you work in Manhattan and you have to drive there. Well, that's another $180 a month you have to pay just to drive there, not counting parking and everything else. And that's a lot of money. You know, if you're somebody who's driving there who has a job as a painter or something, and maybe you park your truck in New Jersey, but during the day you have to drive, that's a lot of money. If you're going to go to New York City in your van, don't take the van into New York City. Park somewhere, park in New Jersey, park at a train station, park in Pennsylvania, take the train, park up further in New York, even as far as Albany, and take the train down. That's the way to see New York City. I mean, $9 may not be that much in the grand scheme of things, but there's a lot of these little $9 coming, and they add up. It is now officially much cheaper for me to fly to Boston from Chicago than to drive, and I sometimes wish it wasn't. Tech Talk. Belt dressing. Hey, you ever heard of belt dressing? This isn't something you wear. This is a spray. It's a sticky thing that you spray on squeaking belts. And back in the day when vehicles had V-belts, which are basically V-shaped belts that go from pulley to pulley, say for your alternator, water pump, fan, whatever, they would sometimes get dry, or there'd be a little bit of a kind of a glaze that would build up from road dirt and stuff on the pulleys, and they needed a little help, and you'd buy the stuff called belt dressing, and you'd spray it on the belt, and typically what would happen is you'd turn on the engine and then turn on the air conditioner. That was a very common way for this to happen, and then the belt would start to squeak, and you would take some belt dressing and spray it on the belt, and it would go away, and maybe that would last a day, maybe it would last a few weeks, whatever. It was a very common thing. In fact, a lot of people with older cars in the 70s would just have a can of belt dressing in there all the time. But it ain't the 70s no more. V-belts are not really used in vehicles very much anymore. I mean, you might find them in tractors and lawnmowers and farm equipment and stuff like that. But in most modern vehicles, vans, cars, trucks, whatever, what you're going to encounter is called a serpentine belt. It's the same idea. It's a belt that connects pulleys to accessories. The engine provides power. The belt takes the power and transfers it to the alternator and other things. Power steering pumps. I mean, there's a long list. But the thing is, the way serpentine belts work is that they distribute the friction needed to maintain contact with the pulleys over a greater distance. And they're made out of a different material. They're much more pliable than V-belts were. V-belts were made out of almost a tire-like material. They had threads in them. They were very tough. And bottom line here is that you don't want to spray belt dressing on them. If you spray belt dressing on a serpentine belt, you're actually adding to the problem. It can increase the squeaking, or at the very least, it's going to gum up a whole bunch of stuff that you may not want to gum up. It's just a different technology, and belt dressings are not for this technology. Now, the companies that make belt dressings maybe will say, special belt dressing for serpentine belts. But if you talk to any mechanic anywhere, they're going to tell you, don't use belt dressings on serpentine belts. And as you know, I had a problem with my van with the serpentine belt, and I did not put belt dressing on it. I actually have some belt dressing, but it's for a bush hog, a billy goat. You ever seen one of these things? It's like a giant lawnmower that eats trees. Yeah, that's another story. But for that, belt dressing makes sense because it has an old style V-belt. But if I had sprayed that inside my Sprinter, it probably would have cost me another few $100 as they cleaned it all out. So what do you do if you do have a squeaking serpentine belt? Well, that means something's wrong. Something needs to be fixed. And whether you need a new serpentine belt or you just need a tensioner tightened, most of them you can't. Most of them are automatic. But if you had one that was self-tensioning, then that needs to be done. If you have just replaced a component, like say an alternator, and your belt is squeaking, you probably need to tighten that alternator more. In a lot of vehicles, the alternator is actually the tensioner. There's a bolt you loosen, and then you can slide the alternator kind of on rails, put the belt on, and then it takes a lot of force to stretch it back against the belt and tighten it down. You almost need two people. Anyway, belt dressings are not for engines that have serpentine belts, and your vehicle probably has a serpentine belt. Product review. I am constantly constantly shocked at how cheap batteries are. When I first did this podcast, the very first battery I bought was about $150. And it was an all-in-one. It had, it was like a Jackery. It wasn't a Jackery. It was much smaller than a Jackery. And little thing, I think it was 20 amp hours. And it was $150. And I thought, oh, that's not bad. And I did the math, and I thought, well, I'm just going to use lights and a fan. 20 amp hours is probably enough. And as it turned out, it was a piece of junk because you couldn't use it and charge it at the same time, which makes it useless in a van. Make sure that whatever you buy for all-in-one power units, you can charge it and use it at the same time, which most of them do. But I never would have bought that thing if I had seen this battery that I found today. Now, this is an example battery. I have not bought one of these. I've never used them. I've never heard of the company, which is Zirbu. But this is a 12-volt, 100-amp-hour lithium phosphate battery, the good one, with a BMS, of course. It has 100 amp hours, so it's a smaller battery. A lot of people have moved way above 100 amp hours, but my first van had a lot less than 100 amp hours, and it did just fine. Has low temp protection, which my very expensive battery in my van now does not have. 15,000 cycles, which means that you can discharge it and charge it 15,000 times, which I wonder where they got that number from, because I'm pretty sure none of their batteries have ever gone through that many cycles. And, it's $134. $134 for a lithium iron phosphate, 100-amp-hour battery. That's pretty nice, and it's even got Bluetooth. I am in shock. And, obviously, I haven't tried this, and it could be a piece of junk, but what... what does a piece of junk battery look like? I mean, maybe, I don't know. I would definitely grab this if I were, I have to buy some batteries. I'm going to wait till the spring. But if this is still available in the spring, I'm going to replace the battery in the Tiki Bago with this. The Tiki Bago doesn't need a whole lot of power because there's not much running off the 12-volt battery, but what I had in there is dead. This is going in there. It fits my needs perfectly. Maximum discharge current on this thing is 1C. That means it'll put out 100 amps. All the specs on this thing are amazing. It doesn't have very many reviews yet. If there's a scam here, I am not finding it. But if you're looking for a battery, you got to take a look at this thing and consider if this is going to work for you. They've got 4.6 stars, 30 ratings. You know how this goes. A lot of this stuff could be fake. But wow, $134. And that's not the only one. Here's another one right next to it for $129. Here's one for $119. It's crazy. So yeah, I feel like I'm just constantly saying, oh, batteries are so cheap right now. Maybe they will continue getting cheap forever. There's some concern about tariffs. These batteries could absolutely go up in price soon. I have no idea what is going to happen. But I know that right now on Amazon, I can get a 12-volt, 100-amp-hour battery for $120. This one does not have as good specs as the Zebro, and I'm going to link to the Zebro. I think that little bit extra money is worth it to have the Bluetooth and to have temperature control. And I don't know what the difference is between cycles. I mean, the Zebro says 15,000. This one says 5,000. Either of those is acceptable in most cases. Sorry if I sound flustered here, because I am. There are a lot of bad things happening in the world, but these battery prices are really opening up a whole new world for folks in vans who want things like air conditioning and electric cooking. And if this trend continues, I mean, everyone's just going to have an all-electric van, which I don't think is a bad thing. Link in the show notes. Tales from the Road. So, Tales from the Road this week is a guest spot by Big Rob of Big Rob's Van. You have probably heard me talk about Rob before. He is a multi-talented man. He's done many, many different creative things, and currently his big push seems to be on YouTube. So I'll have a link to his YouTube channel in the notes, but it's Big Rob's Van. And Rob wants to talk about something that he can talk about in a way I can't talk about, because we have different backgrounds on this issue. And that issue is guns. So if you don't want to hear about guns, go ahead and skip forward about 12 minutes. But if you want to hear a story about guns and the problem with guns and borders and some solutions, go ahead and listen as Rob takes over.
Hello, fellow listeners of the podcast. My name is Rob, and I am the owner of Big Rob's Van. On episode 239 of the Built to Go podcast, Jeff discussed some of the complications that come with traveling with a weapon in your van. This reminded me of one of my own tales from the road that happened a few years ago, and I would love to share with you today. I was born, grew up, and currently reside in Oklahoma. Now, I know what you're thinking, and no, I've never actually ridden a horse. I've never worn cowboy boots or owned a cowboy hat. Although, full disclosure, my house does back up to a large piece of property, and on occasion, I can hear cows mooing from the back porch during the day and coyotes howling at night. Now, Oklahoma, like Texas, is gun country, but despite that, the only gun I had growing up was a Daisy 880 BB and pellet rifle, which I used to shoot Coke cans and Red Solo cups and occasionally birds and rabbits. Now, fortunately, birds and rabbits are pretty fast around here, and I'm a pretty bad shot. Fast forward several decades, and throughout my career, I have done an awful lot of traveling for my job. And although my supervisor would really prefer that I fly to these destinations, I have always preferred to drive. I live within a stone's throw of Route 66, so road trips have always been in my blood. I have driven to all 48 lower states, and long before I owned a van, I slept in my car and later in my truck, and many rest stops outside casinos and behind busy hotels. Now, with all this driving, it was my dad who suggested that I purchase a gun. You could break down on the side of the road, he said, or end up in some sketchy motel. Now, I kind of think having a self-defense weapon in my car is a lot like having a toilet in my van. It's super important when you need one, but I've also crossed this country dozens of times without one. Now, eventually he convinced me, and that's kind of where today's story starts. Now, at the time all of this happened, Oklahoma required its citizens to acquire what they called a concealed carry license. Now, to get this license, I had to attend 8 hours of classes and then pass a target proficiency shooting test. And by the way, if you're worried about passing one of those shooting tests, I will let you know that I had to shoot a paper plate using a .22 caliber target pistol from about 10 feet away. Even a guy who couldn't hit birds and rabbits as a kid could shoot a happy face pattern into one of those plates. Now, what was more important to me was the classroom portion of the program. That's where you go learn all the laws that apply to a concealed carry license, and that includes learning about reciprocal states. Now, this is a system where some states honor gun licenses from other states, and this is way more complicated than you might think. For example, if I want to go visit family members in Indiana, I am legally allowed to carry a weapon here in Oklahoma and Missouri, but not in Illinois. But then it's okay again for me to have it in Indiana. And on top of this, each of these states have different laws. For example, in Oklahoma, I could theoretically walk down the middle of Main Street with an AK-47 strapped to my back, but I cannot carry a weapon inside any establishment whose primary source of income is alcohol. And the punishment for breaking these laws is very serious. They could lead to fines or even prison time. So it's pretty important to know the rules. So this story took place a few years ago. My family and I took a road trip to go visit Niagara Falls. This is roughly a 1,300-mile drive from Oklahoma, but it was even longer for us because we went to go visit family in Chicago and stopped at many other things along the way. My kids got to go to the top of the St. Louis Arch, for example, for the first time, and all of us had a good time at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. Now, because this was such a long road trip, I decided to bring my gun with me. Now, I don't carry my gun on me during these trips, but I had it in the case and in the back of our van. I specifically stashed it underneath our suitcases so that it would not be easily seen, but it would be accessible if I needed to get it. Now, while we were visiting the house from A Christmas Story, my wife and I were discussing how I had to hide my gun while traveling through Illinois and whether or not it was even worth bringing. And during that conversation, she mentioned that our hotel the next night would be in Niagara Falls, overlooking the falls. However, this is the first time she mentioned to me that our hotel would actually be across the border in Canada. Now, as complicated as gun laws are in the United States, I knew that Canada was much more strict about guns. I immediately had this image in my head of a Canadian Mountie going through my car, finding the gun, and sending me directly to Canadian jail, which, full disclosure, I think is probably a lot nicer than an American jail. But I began to panic at this moment. I knew that stuffing my gun underneath our luggage was not going to fool anybody, especially if our car got searched at the border. All of a sudden, I had a very real problem to deal with, and that was we were on our way to Canada, and I had a gun in my car that I knew I could not take across the border. Now, while traveling at 70 miles an hour from Ohio towards the Canadian border at Niagara Falls, I had to come up with a plan. Now, of course, given a few days back home and using some tools, I'm sure I could have hidden a gun in my van. I could have removed a panel or stuck it underneath a spare tire, which, now that I think about it, is probably all the places they search for guns at the border. Complicating matters is the fact that I have the world's worst poker face. My friends love playing cards with me because they can instantly tell by looking at my face whether or not I'm holding a good hand. I know myself and know there is no way I would be able to keep a straight face if we got to the border and I was asked directly if I had anything in our car that they needed to know about. Now, because our route was taking us to New York, I came up with a genius plan. I know that gun ranges in Oklahoma will rent you a locker where you can stow a weapon. So my idea was to call a gun range in New York, sign up for a locker, and then stow my gun there for a day or two while we went across the border. Now, if you're from New York, you may be having a good laugh at me right now, and that is for a couple of reasons. Number one, New York does not have reciprocal gun laws with anybody. And number two, New York has some of the strictest gun laws in the country. I looked up the phone number for a gun range in New York. I called, and the employee I spoke with, after explaining my plan, told me that if I did that, he would confiscate my weapon, call the police, and have me arrested on the spot, which, all things considered, sounded like a pretty bad way to spend my vacation. Now, after much brainstorming, I came up with what I believe to be a brilliant solution. My wife and I at the time had really got into geocaching. Now, geocaching is a hobby where coordinates are given and people go to different locations to find little trinkets. And maybe because I had geocaching on the brain, that's how I came up with my brilliant, and I'm stressing brilliant, plan. And that was to exit the interstate, drive down a dirt road, and then dig a hole. I could bury my gun there. Now, did I have a shovel with me? No. My plan was to turn down one of those little interstate exits that seemed to go to nowhere, drive a mile or two off the interstate, dig a hole with my hands, bury a firearm in this hole, and then drop a Google pin so that later when we returned several states away, I could find the gun, dig it up, and we could go home. What could possibly go wrong with this plan? Well, a lot, if you think about it. I mean, it is a pretty stupid idea, but literally, this was the only thing I could come up with. Now, I was all ready to implement my plan when my wife proposed an alternative one. She said that U-Haul sold small rental lockers by the week or sometimes by the day. Now, that seemed like a little bit of overkill to me, but it did sound better than being on my hands and knees and digging a hole on public property. And so that is what we did. We Googled the nearest U-Haul, which happened to be in Erie, Pennsylvania. We went there and we rented a storage unit the size of a broom closet. Of course, they charged me extra for a padlock because I didn't have one. Now, my wife had some trash bags in the van, and so we used those to create what I like to refer to as a dirty laundry gun sandwich. We filled the bottom half of the bag with dirty laundry from our trip. We put the gun in the gun case in the middle, and then we filled the rest of the bag up with more dirty laundry. I'm sure we probably got some strange looks at U-Haul as we walked to our storage unit, carried in one bag of what looked like garbage to them, put it in our locker, sealed it closed with a padlock, and went back to our van to continue our trip to Niagara Falls. Now, I have to say that that took a load off my mind. We had a wonderful trip at Niagara Falls. The kids and I rode the Maiden of the Mist boat tour and all got splashed by the falls. We went to the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, and we went across the border to one of the worst wax museums I have ever been to in my life. The wax figures were so terrible that we played a game in which we tried to guess who each person was supposed to be. And you know you're at a bad wax museum when a debate breaks out as to whether the figure is Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz or Michael Jackson. After a couple of days, we began our drive back home. Now, normally we take a different route home from our vacations than the one we took to the destination, but because we had to return to pick up a package from Erie, Pennsylvania, that is the route we took home. We went back, we retrieved our mysterious bag of seeming garbage, and came home. Now, since this happened, Oklahoma has changed its gun laws, and citizens are no longer required to apply for or own a conceal and carry license. More than that, anyone in the state is allowed to carry a weapon, whether or not it is open or concealed. I honestly don't know how I feel about that, because I feel like I learned a lot about the laws by attending those classes, but that's all probably a topic for another podcast. But what I can tell you is if you're going to carry a weapon in your van, you need to check and double check the rules, regulations, and laws about that weapon, not just in the state you live in or the state that you're going to, but any states that you may be passing through. This could apply even more in the future with the House bill Jeff recently mentioned on episode 240 that might add gun ranges to national parks. You might be able to carry your gun in the park, but getting it to the park could be a different challenge. Hey, safe travels to everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast, and thanks to Jeff for letting me share my own little tale from the road.
Thanks very much, Rob. Fascinating tale, and I hope I never run into that situation, but I will be carrying a shovel with me just in case. If you have a story that you would like to share on the show, that is something we can do. Get in touch with me at jeff@builtogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1, and we'll figure it out. And if you don't want to record your own voice, I'm happy to read your story as well. A place to visit. Right before I got to South Dakota, which would be my 50th state, there was this beautiful valley with a turnout and a sign to read. And like I always say, stop and read the signs because you will learn stuff. And I learned something here that was a little surprising to me. So this is in Hettinger, North Dakota. That's H-E-T-T-I-N-G-E-R. Hettinger, North Dakota. It's on Highway 12, and I'll have a link in the show notes. It's not that hard to find. In this valley, and imagine this, you've parked your van and you've gotten out and you're standing in this overlook area, a couple of picnic tables maybe, I don't remember, looking over this beautiful valley that sometimes has mist rolling through it and a couple of trees, but it's mostly grassy. And it's not exactly like a box canyon. It's not a box canyon at all, but it's that idea. It feels very enclosing. Like if you were down there, you would feel like you were enclosed in a big, big area. And according to the sign, in 1883, there were only 10,000 buffalo left in this herd that was in this valley. And it was the last herd. The last one in the entire country. Buffalo, or as they're properly called, American bison, used to roam all over, and they were just incredible numbers of them and devastating the landscape. And there's a reason the prairies are the prairies and don't have trees. Some of that has to do with the animals that live there. Just like the African savannah, it doesn't have so many trees because the elephants, etc. Anyway, other story. But after the Civil War, and if you remember, Sherman marched through the South. After the Civil War, Sherman marched through the West with a mission to kill all the buffalo. It was a mission from the federal government to kill all the buffalo to deprive the indigenous folks of a way to support themselves. A little bit more of a story there, too. We're going to set that aside, and we're going to take a look at this valley where over 1,000 of the last 10,000 buffaloes were slaughtered for their meat right in this valley that you are looking at if you're where I was. Now, who killed them? I would have guessed Sherman or Sherman's troops or whatever, or, you know, the people who were killing buffalo just to get their tongues. More story. But no, it wasn't. It was Sitting Bull and 1,000 Sioux from Standing Rock. they realized that the end was coming, that Buffalo were going away, and they thought, well, here's our last chance. And so far as we know, this was the last big buffalo hunt that the native peoples did, and it was way back in 1883, and it happened in this valley that you are looking at. Now, there's no buffalo there now. You can see, though, why this would be an ideal place to hunt buffalo, because, like I said, it was very enclosing, and you could see the buffalo only had one way to go, and if you can predict where the buffalo were going to go, you can stop them, you can hunt them. Now, the history of the American bison is rife with lessons. There's lots of things to learn about American history and the history of the bison and the history of warfare and how Sherman's tactics weren't to kill the people. It was to kill the support for the people so that they'd be pressured to end what they were doing, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of things to learn there. But if you visit this site, which is 10 miles east of Hettinger on Highway 12, you can stand over the same vista that once was filled with 10,000 bison. And you can imagine what it would have been like to be Sioux sitting on your horse, looking down at the last buffalo herd and knowing that this was going to be your last buffalo hunt. Because from my reading, they did know it was part of their decision to do this. And if you take all that into perspective, it makes that vista a whole lot more powerful. So, heck, if you're in that area, or if you really like buffalo, and honestly, I think buffalo are tasty. Oh, that's another story. Anyway, go ahead and check this out. It's called The Last Great Buffalo Hunt Site, and it's in Hettinger, North Dakota. I will have a link in the show notes. Resource recommendation. Okay, this is not my normal kind of resource. Normally, I'm looking at a resource that is strictly for van life, has something to do with van life, and if even if it's just entertainment, it still has something to do with van life, because it's an entertaining podcast that you can listen to while you're driving, or something like that. This isn't that. This is purely, I guess you'd call it personal promotion, except that I'm not really promoting anything. Like I said, I'm not a business person. I make things. If people want to look at them or listen to them or read at them, that's great. But I'm never going to push it on you. I'm not a salesperson. I'm not an evangelist. I'm like, there's this thing here. If you're interested, click. And that's the end of the transaction. And I am now going to present to you what is essentially a blog. It is a blog. It's a bunch of things I've been writing lately. Some people like them. And they have something to do with van life. They usually have to do with travel. And they're very personal, so my restrictions on politics and religion are broken in these things, because I don't have them. This is my personal thing. And heck, I thought I would share that with you. You're spending the time to listen to me on this podcast. Some of you have said that you've listened to every single episode and have gone back and listened to them again, which blows my mind. But if you are curious as to what I think of certain things happening in the world and what certain travel experiences I've had, then this blog might be of interest to you. And I think I'm going to turn it into a podcast, a separate podcast, completely separate for Built2Go. Maybe it'll be called The Jeff Wag Show. No, I am not trying to create anything that is that focused. I just have these thoughts and I want to write them down and put them out in the universe. And if one person reads them, I'm satisfied. And my dad already read this one, so I'm good for my latest one, which is about going to a school called the Witchcraft School. If you look at some maps that were made in the 70s of Salem, Massachusetts, right there on a hill, it says Witchcraft School. And that's where I went. That was my elementary school. And my latest blog post talks about some of the lessons I learned there and how those lessons helped inform a recent trip I took to a concentration camp. So anyway, I apologize for the self-promotion here, but if that's something you're interested in, I've called it something ridiculous and impossible to remember, Peregrinus, or Peregrinus. I don't even know how to pronounce it, and yet that's what I picked. I'll have a link in the show notes, but it's how dumb is this? You want people to look at your stuff, you name it something, whatever. Peregrinus. I might have to rethink this, but Peregrinus, which is an interesting word to look up. I have the definition on the blog itself, and you'll see why I picked it. It's perfect. That's why I'm using it, even if it's not good for business. So link in the show notes. It's peregrinus.ghost.io, because I'm not fancy enough for that Substack thing. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to this, again, rather unusual podcast. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I will maybe not be on Facebook, but you can find me at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Until next time, remember the words of Sameh El-Sayed, who said, "The greatest challenges humans face throughout their lives are two: the challenge of where to start and the challenge of where to stop."